Hello and welcome to EpiCast, a podcast series about epidemics from Sonar Global, a social science network funded by the European Commission. The aim of these podcasts is to explore the social dimensions of infectious disease outbreaks so that we can get better at controlling them. For this first episode, we will be focusing on the coronavirus outbreak. My name is Annie Wilkinson and I'm a researcher at the Institute of Development Studies in the UK, and I will be presenting this first EpiCast. As of the beginning of March, the coronavirus has been detected on all continents except Antarctica, and it looks to be spreading. It is dominating the news and governments are bracing themselves for major impacts. So what has social science got to offer? To explain that, I'm going to hand over to Claire Wenham, Assistant Professor of Global Health at the London School of Economics in the UK, as she summarised very clearly why social science was important and also how it was different.
So as social scientists, we want to look beyond the epidemiological data. We want to think about what other ways of asking questions can we get to the heart of these issues. We recognise that behind every case number we might see from governments or from ministries of health or the World Health Organization, there's a story to tell. And it's really important that this outbreak understands that case numbers are people who have multiple competing priorities every day, and that we need to understand the broader effects of public health interventions to limit transmission of disease, what impact that has on individuals, communities, and different groups.
So we're looking for stories beyond the data. What is the broader context? What is being missed? For the rest of this episode, you're going to hear from a number of experts, both social scientists and epidemiologists, who either work in affected regions or who work on health and disease. We asked them to tell us what they thought were some social factors which are, or are going to be, important in managing the disease and its spread, and especially if they thought there were things which were being overlooked and which required more attention. So, like you heard Claire just then, these scientists kindly recorded their thoughts and sent them in to us. While some of our contributors spoke about China specifically, others spoke more generally, and all of them provide insights or raise questions which have implications for the way the world copes with the expanding epidemic. A big theme was politics and political economy, and the way state-society relations will shape what is and isn't possible in different places. First up to discuss this is Sarah Davies, Professor of International Relations at Griffith University in Australia.
The social factors that are going to be important when thinking about the continued spread of COVID and its control is going to be transparency, trust, and reconciling individual human rights with collective rights. When I talk about transparency, I'm talking about the capacity of governments to be able to communicate suspected outbreaks, confirmed outbreaks to their population in a prompt and regular and open manner through a variety of different mediums, from traditional media to social media. This requires a government being familiar with transparent communication with its population, with populations trusting their government conducts transparent communication with them. When we talk about transparency, we are relying or assuming that the relationship between the population and the government is one already built on trust. A lot of populations, though, don't always trust their governments. However, what's important to think about is the type of trust that populations have in their governments in times of emergencies as a stress point, if you like, from the type of latent trust that they have in their governments during what we would call peacetime. It's fair to say that in democracies or in governments or in societies where populations have more open access to communication, are able to express their dissent of the government, and have a stronger degree of social, civil, economic, and political rights, the conditions are better for the relationships of trust and transparency to survive during an emergency than they are in locations where individual human rights are often under stress and pressures and often being denied to individuals. In stressful times, in fragile situations, those locations where there is not already a good reservoir of trust and transparency between the population and the government, it will be much harder to ensure that populations are reporting openly and honestly to their government, and for populations to believe that their government is reporting openly and honestly with them.
Our next contributor is Biao Jiang, Professor of Social Anthropology at the University of Oxford. The story Biao points to is the transformation of China's economy. He urges us to consider the way mobility is baked into lives and livelihoods in China, in what he calls the mobility-based economy.
Epidemics, of course, are always related to population mobility, but the COVID-19 outbreak is special in that in China 2020, population mobility is not only more prevalent and frequent, but also it has become a basis of economy and many people's livelihood. Just imagine people like taxi drivers, people working in the logistics sectors, in the service centers. They will need to move in order to work. And also they need other people to move in order to have demand for their services. And China today, people, as compared to 2003, when SARS break out, mobility has becoming a really generalized feature across society. This explains why in 2003, migrant workers were identified as a key priority group when the government tried to contain the SARS virus. But this time, migrant workers were hardly mentioned at all. Why is that? Because mobility now is no longer specific to migrant workers as a social group, but the mobility just become a generalized activity that any people is practicing. And this explains a few phenomena related to the COVID-19 outbreak. Number one, this probably explains why the local government in China in the beginning tried to cover up or downplay the seriousness of the virus. It's precisely because mobility and circulation was so important for the economy, so any kind of disruptions can have far-reaching consequences. But this, the generalized mobility, also explains why late January the government launched a kind of all-out war-like campaigns in order to contain the virus, as compared to 2003, which is more differentiated and target particular groups. Since now everyone is moving, you know, the only way government can do is to try to ask everybody to stop. So there's a kind of a total demobilization strategy. Certainly, I think this also explains why the reaction during this outbreak can be particularly disruptive. Because the economy is so dependent on mobility, circulation, movement, given the supply chain capitalism is the dominant paradigm. Therefore, the abrupt halt of mobility can have consequences for both businesses and, but more importantly, for many ordinary people's livelihood.
Next, we return to the subject of political economy and hear my colleague Wei Xin, a research fellow at the Institute of Development Studies, emphasizes how political cultures can impact on the medical supply systems which are so crucial for COVID-19.
It is estimated that around 20% of people infected with COVID-19 require intensive medical care in the hospitals at some point, meaning that the outbreak with a large number of patients would put healthcare system to the brink of collapse. If there are no sufficient beds, medical equipment, protective gears for the doctors and nurses, and so on. Wuhan is a city with over 30 top-quality public hospitals in China, but still the whole system nearly collapsed, and particularly at the first 2 or 3 weeks during the crisis, due to lack of infrastructure, equipment, medics, and other resources. So how this massive material flow can be managed, and by who? And China is an authoritarian regime, as we all know, it relying on strong state or central government to organize and distribute all these supplies, which appears to have some obvious advantages and disadvantages. On the one hand, large infrastructure like temporary hospitals can be constructed in days, and expensive medical equipment, such as ECMO machine, can be imported and delivered. So now we have around 100 ECMO machines in Wuhan alone. So this shows how efficient the state-led system can be. But on the other hand, it shows that small materials like face masks, goggles, and medical suits cannot be effectively managed in this so-called total state system. It seems that lacking strong civil society groups in China make distribution of large amount of donations, purchases, very difficult, very challenging. So as a result, in the first 2 weeks of outbreak, many frontline doctors and nurses are not even well protected. They lack sufficient protective gears when they're saving lives in the emergency rooms. Their strong professional ethics is heroic, admirable, but such situation has led to a large number of infections among these medics. So unfortunately, we have over 14 people, 14 doctors died in Wuhan. So hence, studies of state civil society relations, logistics supply, and production systems are particularly useful in a crisis like this.
Talking of medical supply systems and how these might differ in different contexts, we return now to Sarah Davies, who reminds us that in many countries there are large informal sectors who provide the majority of care and communication and cannot be overlooked in the COVID fight.
I think one of the things that is going to be very important in the outbreak is to recognise that in different systems, health systems, there is a reliance on different types of actors to provide that daily communication of outbreak control and flow of information. A lot of the way in which we think about public health emergency response at the moment naturally focuses on state-led health systems. This is important, and we certainly would not want to see an undermining of strong health system capacity being led by the public sector. However, in a number of countries, populations, sometimes the vast majority of populations, will seek their healthcare through private providers or depend upon their healthcare from community healthcare workers, volunteer healthcare worker capacity. This is particularly the case in low and even middle-income countries where you don't always have a high volume of trained healthcare professionals serving populations, particularly in your rural locations, in your ethnic minority populations, or in your very low-income populations. So we need to make sure that we're looking at the different modes of communication about this outbreak that are being spread through those very important actors who are not often part of the formal institutional set, but have a very important role to play in communicating the message to those who are very vulnerable to disease and can, of course, be able to spread the disease in areas and in locations that may be very difficult for us to detect because of their having to continually exist within these informal networks.
A second theme was decision making and the communication around decisions. First, Wei Xin takes us back to the early days of the epidemic and reflects on some missteps at that critical early stage.
The first implication is about information disclosure, transparency, and public behavior management. In China's case, the early warning signs in the late December 2019 among the frontline doctors were treated as rumors and suppressed first by their hospitals and then by the police. So the chance of earliest response slipped away due to the attempt of information control. But on the contrary, after the outbreak was confirmed by the government, their decision of a total lockdown in Wuhan City was released to the public 10 hours before its taking effect, without any attempt to control expectable public anxiety or fear. So such decision has led to millions of people fleeing the city during these 10 hours, and later on, urging people rushing into the hospitals, pharmacies, and even supermarkets for medical advice and supplies. and consequently causing numerous new infections in the next couple of days.
Next, we have Lisa Lin from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine in the UK, who poses a key question about the motivations and influences on decision making.
What were the factors influencing the countries and airlines to impose strict travel restrictions, mass evacuations, and widespread flight cancellations in early February? These decisions come with massive economic and social impact and could have potentially inflated public risk perception, even fear. Were these decisions made based on epidemiological data at the time, or were they based on other social factors such as political tension, media sensation, or public fear? Answers to these questions will inform the epidemic control strategies for current and future outbreaks.
Picking up on this theme, we have Arnaud Fontanet, Head of Emerging Diseases Epidemiology at the Institut Pasteur in France. Arnaud gives us some epidemiological insights into the relative mortality figures and how these play into public perceptions and ultimately the decision-making processes which Lisa has highlighted.
At the end of the day, these epidemics and their impact is not going to be evaluated on the basis of how many people ultimately died or got severe disease. If you look at SARS, for instance, it is ridiculously low compared to other infectious diseases. SARS, after 6 months of an international crisis, killed less than 1,000 people. Every day, you have 1,500 people dying of malaria, same number for HIV, same number for tuberculosis, even more for viral hepatitis. And if you take the example of flu, flu is killing every year estimates of 200,000 to 600,000. I mean, nobody knows really, but let's say hundreds of thousands of people in the world. And still the impact of flu is much lower. And it is important to try to understand why such a new virus is creating a panic in society with some sort of disproportionate reactions when other diseases kill a lot. Still, I'd like to take a little bit more distance with this story about flu. Because one thing that people underestimate is, although flu is killing, we don't know about it in our personal experience. Why? Because flu is killing indirectly. If you take the example of France, for instance, every year, on average, you would have 10,000 of people dying of flu. However, if you look at how many people had flu as the cause of death on the death certificate, it's going to be less than 500. And the reason for it is that would be recorded as death from flu only the people that really had this viral pneumonia as the primary symptom, sent to intensive care unit, dying of it. And sometimes it's young people of that. But the vast majority of people who would die of flu will die because of a sort of decompensation of some form of morbid state. So this is going to be someone in their 80s that have hypertension, diabetes. They will do a myocardial infarction. And we will learn that a few days before they were not doing so well, maybe some sort of respiratory disease, minor. But it's not going to be viewed as a death from flu. So I'm not surprised that people are not so aware in the population that flu is killing so much, because these are really indirect deaths, which, by the way, are just calculating by looking at the seasonal mortality over 20 years mm-hmm. in a population. And then you look at the peak of mortality during the winter, and you look at when was the peak of the epidemic, of the flu epidemic, and where it coincides. By subtraction, you say, wow, 10,000 of people died in excess at the time of the flu epidemic, and that's why, where those 10,000 come. But people don't see it. And here with this new coronavirus, first of all, it's a new virus, so there is all the anxiety going about with it. Then we need to learn about, well, what exactly is its dynamic for spread, eventual related mortality, etc. And the people that are going to die of it will have coronavirus diagnosis attached to it. So I think the impact is going to be much bigger. The second point I'd like to mention is that with seasonal flu, it's really primarily older people with comorbidities who are going to die. It's going to be true also for this coronavirus, but not to the same extent. From the statistic we have in China, 80% among all those people who die, 80% are more than 60 years of age, which means 20% are younger than 60 years of age. And that is much more than what you would have for seasonal flu. So the number, the proportion of deaths among young people is going to be higher, and that emotionally is going to be more difficult. And that's where I think it's very important to try to explain as much as we can, as the knowledge accumulates, all what we learn about it, so that we can prepare the population to what is happening. And it's also where the social scientists can have a crucial role.
A third big theme raised by our experts was inequality and vulnerability, which arguably hasn't received a lot of attention, as the global pandemic framing, in which we're all at risk, tends to downplay the differences within populations, where different people face very different risks. To begin with, Wei Xin explained some of the challenges facing lower income households in Wuhan.
The last implication is that the outbreak have tremendous implications for social inequalities, as some social groups will be particularly vulnerable during and after the crisis. Low-income groups will be hit hardest economically if the lockdown persists, if the factory closure persists, and if the economic activities freeze over months. Poor household, they have smaller flats, fewer rooms to share, so if one family member is infected with the virus, it is nearly impossible to implement home isolation. They lack information, and often the last group to think about protection. When they are aware of that, very often the gears are already running out in the market. In China's case, getting some medical equipment during a crisis is nearly a manifestation of very good social networking or social capital. These groups can be very easily misled by the fake news and the rumors that leading to wrong and dangerous behaviors or actions. For example, one rumor that some herbal medicines can be very useful has led to another mad rush of among some of these people to the pharmacies, and hence having new infections. But most oftenly is that these groups are simply forgotten during the crisis. For example, during the large number of people in Wuhan mental health center and prisons were infected, but they're not even noticed until very recently. So it is almost certain that some groups will face particular hardships and difficulties even after the crisis. So how to build up protective capacities during the crisis and their resilience afterward?
Next, we have Claire Wenham again, who directs us to the differences between men and women and the potential for increased impacts on women.
So, in particular, we think that one group of people who have been widely missed by a lot of the discussions that are happening at the moment are women and other marginalised groups. Now, the reason we talk about this as social scientists is we think there are both direct and indirect effects on women in this outbreak. So, from a direct perspective, the issue we need to think about is what role women play as healthcare workers, either paid or voluntary. Recent data out of China suggests that 70% of the healthcare workers working on the front line in Wuhan are women. So how are their differential needs being met, and how can not recognizing that the workforce are women predominantly, how can that impact the transmission of disease and the impacts, the secondary impacts of the disease? We also don't have accurate sex disaggregated data about who is being infected. We know that more men are dying, but we don't necessarily have a full complete picture of whether women and men are being infected at the same rate. And this is important because this can tell us a lot about who is at risk and who is most vulnerable to it. There are also a range of secondary effects that we need to think about. What happens, for example, when schools are shut? Who picks up the additional care and labour of looking after children if schools are shut? We know that according to most social norms, it's women that then perform this role. So then what impact does that have on their own economic security, their own jobs, their own other responsibilities that they might have? We also know that travel bans that have been implemented can impact women more than men. For example, there is domestic workers in Hong Kong and Singapore, for example, who are predominantly from the Philippines and Indonesia. When travel ban comes in, which means that they are no longer able to return to work if they're at home, how does that then impact women disproportionately to men? And a final secondary impact of measures to control this outbreak might relate to quarantine. Are women's differential needs being met in these quarantine settings? Are we sure of their security? Are we providing them with what they need, different, which might be different to men?
Building on Claire's points, Sarah Davies discusses the way that even among women or other marginalised groups, there are likely to be big differences as people have multiple identities which can overlap, making them more or less vulnerable.
The other areas that we need to be keeping in mind when we're thinking about an outbreak such as this is that people have different types of intersectional representations. So you can have a woman who may be quite have a high income and may be of a majority ethnic group and have a lot of choice in the way in which they receive their information, act upon information, and take action in response to an outbreak such as this. But as we've just heard from Claire, there are also another of other women who cut across different income levels, who cut across different social norms, and who cut across as well different civil and political liberties that not everyone has the same. So what this means is that when we're thinking about the impact of this outbreak, we need to be aware that not everyone, for example, is going to be able to access a formal healthcare system. There are going to be families and individuals who are going to think twice about whether or not they can afford access to a healthcare system for the type of symptoms that they may be having. There's also going to be concern if you're thinking about ethnic minority groups in countries where they are already under forms of persecution or closer observation than the majority ethnic groups. They are maybe going to be more reticent in coming forward with their symptoms, coming forward to report what is going on in their communities, which means that there may be an entire areas around the world where we simply do not know the impact of COVID on those particular groups because of the civil and political liberties that they have not always been able to, they've been denied in their particular country. And this has an impact then on the outbreak response, on the information that these communities receive and their trust in the information that they're receiving from their government.
Our final thoughts come from Lisa Lin again, who reminds us of the stigma and racism which often accompany epidemics, but also of the crucial role of social science in identifying and combating these forms of discrimination.
Stigmatization and discrimination during epidemics have been well documented and consistently correlated with racism and xenophobia, often spread through the media. There has been a rise of reported incidents of discrimination and even violence against East Asian communities, which might have been driven by political tension, media sensation, public fear, or racism. Communication strategies should be developed for individuals and for governments to counter the conspiracy theories, fake news, and racism and xenophobic content sometimes found in the public forum.
That's it for this first EpiCast from Sonar Global. I hope you found it interesting. A big thank you to all our contributors and to all of you for listening. And we leave you with one final comment from Wei Xin, originally for Wuhan, but I think now relevant elsewhere.
Wuhan, 加油!